And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome to Culture Calculus. I am Kavitha Davidson. We're really excited for today's episode. Joining us will be Congressman Colin Allred, former NFL linebacker for the Tennessee Titans and current representative of the 32nd District in Texas. And we're going to talk about, you know, some of the issues that really matter to him, including paid parental leave and his experience being in the Capitol building during the January 6th insurrection. And joining us later in the show will be our Indianapolis Colts beat reporter, Stephen Holder, to talk about our conversation with the congressman and his own experiences with fatherhood and paid parental leave. Well, first of all, I am extremely pleased to welcome Representative Congressman Colin Allred to the show out of the 32nd District in Texas, representing Dallas. Thank you so much, Congressman, for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you have an extremely interesting backstory. You played football in the NFL and in college, and now you have transitioned to full-time politics. First, you know, let's start with your football career. You played at Baylor. When you were at Baylor, did you want to play professionally? Was that the ultimate goal?
No. I mean, you know, obviously I wanted to, but I didn't think I was going to be able to. You know, we weren't very good, I'll be honest, when I was there. That was the rough years for Baylor. In fact, when they came to recruit me, initially I was kind of like, oh, there's no way I'm going to go there. But through a series of events, it ended up being the best option for me. And I was prepared to go to law school. I took my LSAT. I sent off my applications and was all prepared to go to law school. And I really had agents start calling me in during 2 days of my senior year, saying they wanted to represent me. And I was like, in what? You know? And finally, one of them, and this is, no, I'm not joking, one of them had to send me my pre-draft scouting report that had me ranked as a fifth to seventh rounder. I went undrafted, but, you know, to convince me that this was a reality. And because I, you know, I was just thinking, well, we're not that great. I haven't even, at that point, you know, my best year was my senior year, so I hadn't even had that year yet. But you know, the NFL looks for body types. They look for certain attributes that, you know, you can't teach. And I guess I had that. And so that's what gave me a chance. And right. From there, I took it. So
that's so interesting. I feel like, you know, we talk to a lot of athletes, especially about their post-retirement careers, and a lot of them had delusions, frankly, about whether or not they would be able to play professionally. Frankly, the NCAA, you know, one of the major stats is how many people actually make it from D1 to the pros, and how many people going into college believe they will. And the disparity there is huge. But you didn't have any of those notions. You used sports to get to college and then law school.
Yeah, for me, it was, I would not have been able to afford going to Baylor. I would probably gone to public school and had to take out loans and hope for scholarships and things like that. But for me, my football in college was always about getting my degree. I started off as a biology pre-med major because in my high school and growing up in Dallas, if you were smart, people said you should be a doctor or a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And so at first I tried to be a doctor.
Let me tell you, growing up Indian anywhere in the country, that's yeah, what people
exactly.
Say.
I mean, I'm telling you, there's something about it, you know, communities of color. And so I tried to be a doctor for my first couple of years. I was biology pre-med. I didn't really like it. So I switched over to history, which I really enjoyed, and with the goal of that leading to law school. But no, for me, it was a means to an end. And even playing the NFL, I saw it as I want to play long enough to pay for my law school. So, mm-hmm.
How did you enjoy your, you know, you were in the NFL for 4 years, you know, never really started all of that. But how did you enjoy your time in the NFL with the Titans?
Yeah, so I was an undrafted free agent. I came in to Tennessee. I was signed by a Hall of Fame scout named C.O. Bricado. who passed away not that long ago, CO came to this like regional combine that I went to, and I didn't even do well. I had the wrong shoes. It was like a grass turf, and I brought like field turf shoes, and I thought it was a disaster, and I thought there's no way this is going to help with anything. But CO called me like the second the draft ended and was like, "Are you afraid to come to Tennessee?" And I was like, "No," and so he signed me. And, you know, basically in that organization, that was of course, the former Houston Oilers, CO found all kinds of players in Texas that no one else knew about. You know, class that I came in, he found Ahmad Hall, who ended up being a fullback for us, who started for a few years. And so I went to the first training camp, got released, and was told, you know, basically that they would look at putting me on practice squad, and then they didn't. And they brought me back at the end of the season. And so I went to, you know, 5 training camps, 5 years with the Titans, which is pretty unusual to be with the same team for 5 years. But I was sort of I was a Jeff Fisher guy in many ways. I figured out what my niche was and how I could be stick in the NFL. And for me on that team, we had 3 good linebackers in our 4-3 defense. I was the number 4 linebacker, and I played all 3 positions, in a strong, weak, middle. And I was the extra backer that came in on short yardage, goal line situations. And if anyone got hurt, I came in. And I played all the core special teams. And so that was my niche, is that I was kind of a Swiss Army knife. I brought a lot of value to my roster spot, you know. And they drafted linebackers every year I was there, and it was every year. It was supposed to be probably my last year that was the draft pick, was supposed to take my place. But they didn't do everything I did, and so I would end up making the roster again. The only reason I, you know, stopped playing is because of my neck injury. In our 5th game, I hurt my neck against the Cowboys in Dallas. It was really, I had been hurting my neck, and it got hurt worse in that game. And that was it. But even then, I had an offer from the Vikings to come see if I could make the team there on a 1-year deal. And I turned it down to go to law school.
So. Right. Which was the ultimate goal. And when you entered law school, what kind of law, did you know what kind of law you wanted to study, and what you wanted to do upon getting that law degree?
You know, it's funny. I thought that I wanted to be a civil rights lawyer growing up, and I thought that was something I was going to go into. But then after I played in the NFL, I initially thought I was going to go into sports law and maybe be an agent or work for a team or run a team, you know, something like that. And when I started taking kind of the first year classes, you know, I think most law students don't know what they want to do until you get into those classes, because some things will interest you and some things are just really boring. And for me, contracts, you know, just really boring. And that's really what being an agent is. I mean, yes, there's also the negotiating side and all that, but I mean, it just didn't strike me. But constitutional law did, mm-hmm. Voting rights and civil rights did. And so at my law school, University of California, Berkeley, you had a chance basically, which is not at every law school, to kind of pick your classes. And so I steered myself down that lane and got to take some great classes in the civil rights area. Worked in the Obama White House while I was there interning, and then also at the Department of Justice. So I spent basically my last year of law school in D.C. working in the Obama administration. And so when I came out, I kind of felt like I'd already been working. And, you know, for me, that worked because I was older. You know, I came in to law school on my second career. I wasn't really there to be a student and kind of just drift through life. You know, I needed to get into my next career. And for me, having that purpose was really important because, as I'm sure, if you talk to any former player, losing that driving purpose of being an athlete, of being a professional athlete, of being at the highest level, it's like a plug is pulled, you know, and you no longer have the thing that energized you every morning.
It's your whole identity.
It's your whole identity. Even if you did like I did and you weren't really planning on it, it still is your identity because you spent so much time doing it, you know. And once that plug was pulled, I really had to find that next passion. Otherwise, I could tell I was going to spin out of control, you know. And so I threw myself into it the same way I threw myself into football and end up, you know, like I said, having sort of a career before I even graduated. And then when I graduated, hit the ground running and kind of went from there.
Right. As a side note, any attorney who tells you that they're passionate about contract law is just lying.
Yeah. They might be passionate about the paycheck. They're
about 100%. So you worked in the Obama administration at Housing and Urban Development under Julian Castro, and you also worked at a private law firm as a voting rights litigator. What was it? I mean, I know that, you know, you're a Black man from Texas, and you know, you studied civil rights and constitutional law and everything, but what was it about being able to argue on the side for voting rights that appealed to you?
Well, for me, I would look at the civil rights field, and there are so many different areas of it. You know, there's fair housing, there's education, there's just workplace discrimination, you know, there's gender issues, you know, race.
Even transportation, which you've
worked on. Huge issue.
One of the subcommittees that you're on.
Yeah, huge issue. I mean, definitely life is impacted by your access to transportation. And if you have a highway running through your neighborhood, right? Environmental racism for sure. But for me, it all boiled down to voting rights, because in our system, your voice is through the ballot. Mm-hmm. And it just so happened to be that while I was in law school, kind of coincided with a real attack on the right to vote in the state of Texas, where I'm from, and really across the country. In 2013, the Supreme Court struck down parts of the Voting Rights Act that really kind of opened the floodgates to some of these really, really egregious laws that we saw coming forward. And Texas was, as always, unfortunately, leading the way in terms of trying to restrict the right to vote. And, you know, you look at it and you think, well, if you want to deal with any of these issues on the civil rights spectrum, you're going to have to deal with it through the ballot, ultimately. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, Dr. King and the civil rights movement saw the Voting Rights Act of 1965 as kind of the crown jewel of the civil rights movement. You know, the Civil Rights Act was very important, but the Voting Rights Act, you know, put that power in the hands of African Americans in the South and across the country, where previously it wasn't there at all, you know. And so for me, voting rights, there's a quote in a Supreme Court case basically saying that voting rights is the source of all other rights, the right to vote, and that if you can protect the right to vote, you protect those other rights at the same time. And so for me, that's why I was really interested in it and wanted to be a part of fighting back against what I saw as something that was un-American.
Well, you eventually make your way into politics, and you challenged Pete Sessions in Congress in the 32nd district. He had, to that point, been the only person to hold that office, to hold that seat. And that district is now a swing district, and you've turned it blue. You know, what was it like to see that kind of transformation in the middle of, you know, Ted Cruz very narrowly beating Beto O'Rourke, like in the middle of what seems to be really this blue wave that has taken over Texas?
Well, you know, it's my hometown, and it was the part of town that I'm from. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sort of North Dallas, a place where, you know, we have enormous inequities, where, you know, we have some of the richest people in the country, and we have some of the poorest people in the country, and they live just a few minutes away from each other. And, you know, I'd grown up there, being raised by a single mother who taught in our public schools here, and with the help of my aunt and uncle. My aunt was also a teacher, and my uncle worked for the government, and the FDA had an office in Dallas. And so it was my home, and I thought, you know, this guy doesn't represent the community that I know. And I knew that he'd been unopposed in 2016. You know, it was considered to be so formidable that he hadn't even had an opponent. But I, you know, I felt like there was a chance to flip that seat, and also just to give my neighbors and the folks I grew up with and the community that I thought we were, even if we didn't win, just give them a chance to have another option. You know, and it really, the campaign became, I think, a really special vehicle here in Dallas, where, you know, people, I think, kind of poured their heart and souls into it. We had families bringing their kids to our campaign office to go knock on doors or to make phone calls, and it became a very, you know, special kind of atmosphere. And I felt like something important was going to happen, whether I won or not, by the end of the process. And of course, you know, in 2018, it was a good year for us in terms of the Democratic Party. We won a lot of elections, but I think what happened in Dallas and what happened in Texas was the result of our own community organizing and deciding that they were going to have a change. And that's really what I believe politics should be, right? I mean, politicians get a lot of the credit, of course, you know, when they win an election. But really, if you look behind the curtain, the organization around it is always driven by volunteers. It's always driven by folks who are spending really their precious free time getting involved in the political campaign or effort to have the community represented the way they want to see it represented. And if the politician can channel that and inspire that, then great. But it's really, you know, they're the ones who win it or not. And they certainly won it for me. And they organized and they decided that they wanted to make a change. And that's why I was able to get reelected in 2020. And that's why I continue to have faith, you know, in our community and in our country. Because I know that as bad as our politics are right now, our people are not as bad as our politics. I'll just say that. You don't have the conversations in your normal everyday life that you see in on cable news or in DC. Like, that's not how people talk. It's not the conversations they're having. And if you actually get out there and speak with people, I think you'll find that, you know, their goals are quite modest. What they want to see from their representatives is, you know, pretty simple, really. And that if you can reflect that, then they'll give you a chance.
Right. You know, when we're talking about access to voting, obviously Texas right now, the Texas House just passed a bill that, you know, you've slammed as being basically voter suppression. It's impossible to talk about voting and the arguments that we're having about it without talking about January 6th, because the entire seed of the insurrection was planted on the basis of, you know, election fraud claims. You're in the House chamber when this is happening. What's going through your mind?
Well, you know, it was, first of all, I didn't have all the information at the time because we were in the process of, you know, pushing back into this challenge, the results of the election. And so I'm getting texts from, you know, my wife and my staff about what's happening, and they're asking where I am. And I'm like, I'm on the floor, which is the response means I'm in the safest place in the country. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, this is, you can't walk onto the House floor unless you are a member of Congress or you're there with a member of Congress, right? It's a very restricted space. And, you know, I started getting more reports that, you know, that the Capitol looked like it was being surrounded and all these things. And then they interrupted our proceedings and came to the microphone and told us, you know, the Capitol had been breached, that they were going to start sealing the doors. I mean, this is, you know, crazy stuff. I mean, these are decorative doors that they're closing. They're not meant to be keep people out. And if you see some of the kind of iconic pictures from that event, there's furniture in front of the doors. That furniture is like what they put legislation on. It's not like supposed to be in front of the doors. That's how they barred the doors to keep these people out. And so, you know, I sent off a text to my wife saying, you know, whatever happens, you know, I love you, because she was at home. She's 8 months pregnant with our 2-year-old. So we had our second son a month after that. And, you know, it seemed like at that point they're telling us to get our gas masks out and, you know, prepare for, you know, I was preparing for basically anything. So, I took off my suit coat jacket, which, number one, you don't do that on the House floor. I've never been on the floor without my suit coat, and I never will be again, hopefully, because I was ready, you know, for whatever may happen. And, you know, I don't know what I thought, but I know that, you know, I was ready to have to do what I used to do, which is put people on the ground, you know. And I never thought I'd have to be doing that in this job. I thought I'd left those days behind me. And, you know, I know a lot of my colleagues told me afterwards that they were staying behind me. You know, I'm like, well, I don't know what I was going to do. I didn't have a weapon or anything. I'm just, you know, going to get in
the
way.
You're the weapon.
Yeah,
You're the weapon in that situation. I've seen so many interviews, you know, Sean Patrick Maloney, Democrat from New York, saying basically, you know, I felt much safer having two formal NFL players, you and Representative Gonzalez, in the House at that time. We're so divided as a country. How do we move on from something like that?
Well, it is tough. I mean, the thing about football that I always loved is that you're working from a common set of facts. We have the saying, football, you know, the eye in the sky doesn't lie. You know, the film does not lie, right? There, you watch the film, it's somebody's fault on any given play. There's a reason why there was a breakdown. There's a reason why that hole was created. and you can address it and you can talk about it, and you will talk about it, you know, exhaustively. I mean, but we work from that common set of facts, because, you know, we're all watching the same film and there's no way around it. And right now, the biggest issue that I see us having is that we're not working from a common set of facts. You know, we have folks who are, you know, you can have your own bubble in terms of information that you receive that may never be pierced by reality right now. And, you know, I think that we have to address some of the online radicalization that's going on in our country. I think it's been in many ways worsened by the pandemic, where folks have just been at home and online and getting themselves spun up on things that are just not true. But it's also true that, you know, leadership matters. And unfortunately, you know, the head of one of the two major parties in our country, as someone who has been the lead dispenser of misinformation, mm-hmm. you know, and this is not a situation that would have occurred, I think, under, you know, George W. Bush or, you know, Mitt Romney when he was the nominee, or John McCain. I mean, this is a new thing, and it's taking the Republican Party down an extremely dark road, and one that I don't think believes in democracy, that I think is inherently authoritarian, that I think is inherently, is very foreign for us. I mean, it's a scenario where they're not really talking about facts. They're talking about, you know, just trying to please the leader. I mean, even these voting laws that we're seeing now, they're not based on anything. They're about trying to make Trump feel good about the big lie that the election was stolen. And, you know, we don't have a government of people. We have a government of laws, and we have a government of a constitution that sets down kind of our values. It's not about an individual. And it's always been true that we've had presidents, good and bad, but who ultimately understood that they were kind of keepers of the flame, that they were there to be custodians of the country and of the democracy.
Well, they respected our institutions, no matter what they believed and what we might have disagreed with them on. They respected our institutions.
Right. And this guy doesn't. And he's extremely dangerous to American democracy. I think he's one of the most dangerous people in the world. And we saw that on January 6th. And, you know, I voted twice to impeach him. And I think that he should not be allowed to seek office in this country. I don't think he believes in our system. And so that has led to a lot of what we're seeing now, is that, you know, he's led this party down this path. And you could say, well, you know, the voters are responding to that on their side, but leadership really matters. And, you know, we've seen this in other countries. We've seen this throughout history, and apparently, you know, it's come here now, this idea that, you know, you can have seemingly otherwise, sane and reasonable people, get caught up in a movement that leads them down a path that is extremely dangerous, even extremely violent. And that's where we have to make sure we don't go, right? And so the 2020 election was incredibly important, as you know, tough as it was. And Joe Biden got the most votes of anyone in our history, and, you know, 80 million votes. And that wasn't, I think, about Joe Biden individually. I think that was a collective decision by so many folks that during a pandemic, when they had to risk their lives to go vote, they cared that much, you know, to do that. And, you know, he's going to win by 7 million votes more over his opponent. I mean, it wasn't really a close election. Mm-hmm. And so I think we need to recognize that too, that, you know, unseating, you know, sitting presidents is extremely difficult. That's only happened a few times in our modern history. You know, Jimmy Carter and H.W. Bush, and you could even argue that H.W. Bush wouldn't have lost if it weren't for Ross Perot, right? So it's very rare. And so to have the country say, that's not the direction we're going to go in, is a positive. And so I think now what I'm most concerned with is protecting the institution of democracy to make sure that sort of the majority will that I know is out there, that was reflected in the 2020 election, that I saw in the 2018 election, that I know, and I think we all know in our communities, is there, that can still be expressed in the next elections, and it's not overturned by gerrymandering or by voter restrictions or by dirty tricks, basically. Because that's, I think that would also be extremely dangerous for us if we have a sustained period where people feel like their voice doesn't matter and sort of minority rule, so to speak, in terms of the people who are not getting the most votes or making the most decisions. And that's really hard for a democracy. And you can see people giving up on the system in a scenario like that.
You just got back from paternity leave. First of all, congratulations. 2 years ago, this is not your first child. 2 years ago, you were the first congressman ever to take paternity leave. First of all, how was fatherhood? How are you and the baby doing?
Yeah, we're great. I mean, you know, we're treading water a little bit. I mean, just like anybody with a 5 or 6 week old who's not able to sleep through the night, you know, or tired and all that. And then the 2 year old is, you know, I think a little jealous at times. And but, you know, we got two boys and I'm looking forward to them growing up and being able to be friends and all that. That's something I didn't have. I was an only child. So, you know, I didn't know my father. So this is taking leave was very important to me. Because even in a job like this, for me, my number one job now is to be their father. And, you know, so I wanted to make sure that I was there for those early days. And, you know, there's a lot of research that's very compelling about how important it is for men to be involved in their children's lives early on, and how that can lead to not only better outcomes for the child, but better outcomes for the home in terms of gender equality in the home. And so, you know, I tried to make sort of a statement about it. I didn't realize actually when I was doing this that I was the first member of Congress to take paternity leave. I'm sure probably been some men before who missed some time but didn't call it that. Mm-hmm. But I'm the first one to take paternity leave. And, you know, as I said, as somebody who didn't know my father growing up, I always knew that when I had kids, I was going to be involved in their lives. And so I've tried to, you know, keep that commitment by taking this leave and also, of course, just on an everyday basis, just being there, you know.
Right. You've long been an advocate for paid parental leave program. You're right now pushing for a national paid family leave program. You've obviously gotten buy-in by now from the White House. President Biden announced family leave as part of his American Families Plan. What is wrong with the current system? Why don't we properly acknowledge the role that parents need, that fathers in particular need to have, and the support systems that they need to be given in order to do that?
Well, you know, we're really the only country of our developed country like ours, democracy, that doesn't have paid family leave. I mean, you look around the world, it's a understood fact that something is going to happen at some point in your life where you're going to have to take some time away from work. And it might not be that you get sick, although, of course, that could happen. It might be that your mother or your father or a family member gets sick, or that you welcome a new child and you need to have a little bit of flexibility to spend some time with them. And I think what we're learning during this pandemic and working remotely and working more flexibly is that when you allow workers to do that, they can be as productive or more productive when you acknowledge the realities of their life. And really, that's all we're doing in a paid family leave program, is just acknowledging reality, which is that at some point you're going to have to miss some work. So 100% of the time, just like in the NFL, we have 100% injury rate, 100% rate of folks are going to need something at some point. You're going to need to miss some time for work to take care of your family. Or to take care of yourself. And, you know, that is just always going to happen. But we've not acknowledged it. And particularly because the people it most impacts at this point in our country are the low income and women of color. And because, you know, if you're a lawyer like I was, your law firm's going to offer you a leave option because they have to because their competitor is, you know. And so they, in the professional class, in many ways, that this is becoming more and more, you know, normal. But for hourly workers, for folks who are struggling to get by, you know, they're having babies and being back at work a few days later when they're physically not able to be there, when they shouldn't be there. You know, they're coming to work sick when they shouldn't be coming to work sick, which we all recognize now. We don't want people doing that, but it's been happening for years now in our country. And, you know, what's I think really happening is that people are being ground under, working more and longer for less, and having a really hard time having children, raising children, having families. And so, you know, you're seeing it, it's reflected in our declining birth rate. You're seeing it, you know, in our productivity and just recognizing the reality that everyone's going to need this, that we should put in place a program that gives everyone that chance to either spend time with their newborn or spend time with their ailing parent or ailing family member, to give them that flexibility, makes them a better worker, makes them more productive in the economy, allows them to stay attached to their employer, and ultimately is the right thing to do. right? And so you mentioned for men, and I'll just really quickly say a lot of men who have access to paternity leave don't take it right now.
Well, right. Actually, I did want to ask you about that. How do you get over the stigma against taking paternity leave even when you have the option?
Yeah, we've got to drop some of this BS, you know, gender role stuff. You know, I mean, raising kids is not just for the women to do. What we're seeing in our society right now is that women have entered the workforce at similar levels to men, but are still doing all the work at home. So they're just doing two jobs, you know, instead of having kind of the previous, you know, I think objectionable setup. This is now just adding too much of a burden. And, you know, as I said, the research is quite clear that for men, spending time with your children or with your child when they're young has enormous ramifications, because it then, there's a Department of Labor study on this, and I put a link to it in my press release when we announced my leave, just I really wanted to stress this, that it even leads men when they take paternity leave to then take on more roles at home, mm-hmm. because it just kind of starts to turn up that knob of, you know, I should be involved in these things. And so it does lead to more gender equity in the home.
Everything gets more equal, not just parenting.
Right. Exactly. So, you know, it's taking, you know, doing the dishes and then, doing the work around the house that is work, you know, and that is time consuming and that needs to be shared. And so, you know, it's BS, but in many employers, I think still, you know, there's a feeling that only a woman having a child should take off time and miss it. And then a man takes it, what's he doing? He didn't have a child. Well, yes, he did. You know, I mean, not the physical part, but you are welcoming a new life into your home, and you have the commitment of, and the time commitment of being involved in that. And so we have to break that stigma for employers, break that stigma for employees. And, you know, if an NFL linebacker doing it, if I'm not manly enough, then I don't know who is, right? So, you know, let's talk about it. Let's talk about how important it is for men to be involved in this. And of course, we're not even talking about, you know, same-sex couples where that's even doubly an issue when you have two men involved. So, I mean, this is a huge issue that we got to break these gender roles. We got to break this idea that men shouldn't be involved in their child's lives.
Right. Well, I'm so glad that you said this. And I know I've already taken more of your time than I promised. So I'll let you go after this. But, you know, we see this stigma in sports so much. I mean, every time a player misses a game because his wife is in labor, some talking head on a radio show yells at him about it. And I'm so glad that we're starting to see active players and, you know, former players like you and people who are involved in the public space, you know, really start to combat that and say, no, my priority right now is not being on a baseball or a football field. It's being in the hospital room with my wife who's giving birth. My last question, I promise my last question. The Cowboys went deep on defense in this draft this year and clearly needed to. But, you know, some analysts haven't been so high on their draft grades. How are you feeling heading into the season?
Okay, so let me preface this by saying I grew up a huge Cowboys fan.
Uh-huh.
And then really didn't like them when I played in NFL. Like, okay. Really didn't like them because some labor issues, like Jerry Jones was like one of the leading owners trying to lock the players out, other issues like that. But anyway,
I'm going to need to have you on a podcast just to talk about that.
But yeah. No, because I was there for the lockout, you know, and we prepared for that for a couple years. And anyway, but now I'm back to being a fan and I want to see them do well because everybody around here feels better when they do. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's interesting what they're doing because they've spent a lot of capital on the linebacker position. I mean, they've had a second round pick in Jalen Smith a couple of years ago, a first round pick in Van Der Esch, and now another first round pick at linebacker within like a 4-year span. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I don't know any team that's put that much capital in the linebacker position. As a linebacker, I'm kind of like, hey, finally, somebody values our position. But I also know there's a lot of great linebackers in the fourth round. Almost every single great player I played with is like, I don't know what it is, but something about the fourth round is where linebackers go. You know, and so I know that, you know, they spent a lot of capital on it. I'm sure, you know, this Parsons kid, he seems like an incredible player. I mean, the game has changed so much even since I left to where running like a 4.7 like I did is like slow, you know, and like a 4.3 is what this kid runs, you know, and he's, I mean, where is that from? You know, that's incredible. But ultimately, their scheme, in my opinion, is the problem, not the personnel. And I don't think Jalen Smith and Van Der Esch became bad players last year. I think that their scheme changed from being an aggressive downhill scheme to one that was a little bit standoffish, and that's why we saw them get gashed a lot. But they needed that help. Obviously, with Dak coming back, hopefully he's full speed and all that. I mean, certainly the contract they gave him indicates that they think he will be. But they've got the tools on offense. Traditionally, when we played the Cowboys every year, they always had the big skill positions were always really good. And it was like the bottom half of the roster that wasn't quite there, because they didn't have that kind of professional team in place, the GM, you know, to kind of really make sure that your second string, your special teams was filled with top players that were the best at what they did, which is also important, you know. And I think they've addressed that more now, to where you're seeing them, you know, not give up three first round picks to move up and get the flashy wide receiver. You know, they stuck and they moved back. And so I like that, you know, and I don't know if this coaching staff is the right one or not, but I think their approach is much more professional than it was. And that, to me, I'm all about process when it comes to sports, and the process will lead to better results ultimately, whether or not it's going to be, you know, this year, or if they have to find a different coach to do it. But I think that the process has gotten better. And so I think you will see them continually be better. The NFC East is not like it's a great division at the moment.
I'm a Giants fan, I know.
Right. I mean, the Giants haven't gotten it together. You know, the Washington football team is doing okay, but I mean, yeah, they're actually building a team over there, so look out for them. And the Eagles have kind of fallen off after their great year. But I mean, so they've got a chance in that division. And, you know, if you have a good quarterback, you can make it. I mean, there's two types of teams in the NFL. There's teams that have a franchise quarterback, and there's teams who want one, you know, and apparently the Cowboys have one. So that's that, they've checked that box. So now they got to fill it in around that. And we'll see, there's my son back there. Yeah, we'll see how it turns out. I think they'll be okay. This kid is first round pick, seems like a great pick, but as you know, it's not just the first round in the NFL draft. I mean, everybody talks about that, but like,
I mean, they pick six consecutive defensive players this year. You know?
Yeah. So clearly they recognize that they had an issue. And so I hope that, you know, I don't want to put too much on rookies, though. I never think that rookies are going to, you know, you're lucky if rookies step in and play a big role. But I like the focus. I'll say that.
Right. Well, Congressman Allred, I appreciate the time so much. I'm so excited to see, you know, what you do with parental leave and you know, voting rights and protecting the vote. So thank you so much for joining us, and good luck.
Yeah, thank you for having me. And thanks for talking about these issues that I know aren't, you know, maybe not what every sports fan is thinking about, but they're important.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Well, joining us now to continue our conversation that we started with Representative Allred is Stephen Holder, our legendary Indianapolis Colts writer. Stephen, thank you so much for coming on the show. How are you doing today?
I'm great. I have never been called legendary, so my day got better. So that is unprecedented for me. But I am doing great. I was doing great, and even better now.
Well, you're probably also doing great because it's not, you know, the draft is long behind us, right?
Yes. Draft season, I think, runs like 3 months now. I don't know. It feels like it never ends, honestly. So, yeah, right. Much better.
Well, so we just talked to Colin Allred, congressman out of Dallas, former NFL player. And one of his, you know, he just returned from parental leave. One of the issues that he's really been pulling for years that is now getting major national buy-in from the White House is for a national paid parental leave policy. Now, first of all, Stephen, you're a father. Can you just talk about why, like, parental leave, but in particular, paternity leave is so important?
Yeah, you know, when we... when we talked about, you know, having this conversation, I started thinking about this and something hit me. And I realized, you know what, we need to have a conversation about just parental leave generally, because we still live in a country where women in corporate America are in some cases terrified about what maternity leave will do to their careers, mm-hmm. right? Like, that's still a thing. I don't know if it's as prevalent as it used to be. I'm not the expert, but I do know that, right? That's a calculation that women still have to make.
It's still something that a lot of women consider, like, will I be putting my job in jeopardy if mm-hmm. I take the maternity leave that I'm actually allowed?
Right, right, which is ridiculous. So it makes me wonder, just generally, like, as America, as a country, what are we doing, and why do we have this dismissive attitude toward families when, you know, and supposedly family structure is a really important thing, I thought, in America, right? You know, so
family values.
Right. Where are they? So it's contradictory, I feel like, you know, just as a country, as a society, you know, we don't really put any emphasis on this, I think, you know, and that's why it does take a little bit of boldness, you know, like on the congressman's part to make this a priority, because it's not something people tend to talk about. So, and to take it even a step further, the paternity side of this is even less discussed. So, yeah, I would tell you that, you know, I do think that it's interesting. All right. So I have a 12-year-old daughter, for example, and I can remember 12 years is not a long time, but I think mm-hmm. conversations have changed a lot over the last 10 or 12 years, because I can remember when my daughter was born taking my laptop with me to the hospital and, like, doing work while my wife and daughter were still in the hospital. You know what I mean? Because that's what was expected of me. I'm a man, mm-hmm. which is stupid, but, you know, that's just the way society seemed to tell me I was supposed to conduct myself. So I did it, right?
Did you have any kind of paternity leave or parental leave afforded you?
I don't recall having that. No, I mean, there was clearly maternity leave. And I mean, yeah, I mean, you could, it was an understanding, yes, you're having a baby, don't come to work, right? But but in terms of, you know, hey, I'm not going to be able to fulfill my responsibilities for the next couple of weeks. Got it. You know, no, that was, mm-hmm. you needed to take time off, you know, and that was taking your own time off. And I think companies, our company, even The Athletic, you know, there's starting to be some priority taken for the paternity side of this. So I think that's a positive. And I really think there's been a progression even in that short period of time. Don't plan on having any babies anytime soon, but were that the case.
You heard it here first.
Right. Not breaking news, because that has been very well established. But but yeah, I think that's progress. Hopefully it's progress, you know.
Yeah. How important, I mean, did you take time off when your daughter was born?
I'm trying to remember exactly what I did. I think it was, now obviously sports writer life is different than, like, normal life, but I think it was, she was born the week before the draft. So that put undue stress on the situation. Speaking of the draft, she just had her 12th birthday. So, it's timely, but, yeah, it was weird. April 20th is her birthday. And so I think it was like a week out from the draft. And I, you know, as a sports writer, you can't compartmentalize. I got to be there. It's the draft. So I think I did take a few days, but I did mm-hmm. show up for the draft, and I did cover the draft in its entirety. Now, could I have done a better job? Probably. Yeah. And should I? Yes, probably. But I mean, you know, we also have flexibility, so I had that going for me, and I feel like I lived up to my responsibilities. But, you know, I think in a normal structured, you know, 9-to-5, you know, work environment, that might have been tougher. You know, it's not like I can just work from home and just, you know, do whatever. You know, not everybody has that flexibility. So yeah, I definitely did prioritize being there, you know, whenever possible. But again, that I think is a unique situation because of what
well,
I
and the
do.
Congressman pointed out, that, you know, it's really going to be low income and, you know, non-skilled, non-professional jobs that need parental leave written into federal legislation, because, you know, in the jobs that you and I do, we've got flexibility in where we do it from and the hours that we set and that kind of thing. If you're, you know, he brought up the example of being an attorney, you know, if you work for a major corporation, they have to compete with other corporations to allow for this kind of leave. But it's really the lower income workers and parents that need this.
Yeah. No, I couldn't agree more. You know, I remember when I was a kid, the oldest of three siblings. And, you know, so now we're going back, you know, X number of years. The number doesn't matter now. I mean, whatever. So I'm 44, right? So you're talking about, you know, when my brother and sister were born, you're talking about the very early 80s. And I remember my dad was in sales and he didn't make a lot of money. And so I have no idea what the company policy was back then, but I just knew that my dad never missed a day of work, you know? And so I just remember my grandmother having to come stay with us for a while and help out. And, you know, my dad missing maybe a day or two of work and was back at it, you know? And I just think that's the way he was raised. And that's the way, you know, he probably raised me. And because what was the alternative, right? So it definitely is something that is really embedded in our culture, you know, that like paternity leave is such a radical, it sounds radical to some people, when in reality, I mean, whether you care about gender roles or not, you know, I think obviously we have definitely started to chip away at those things, right? Hopefully, right? But whether you care about that or not, there is so much value in having both parents participate, right? I mean, first of all, it's just necessary. And so I just think about, you know, how maybe I could have benefited maybe from my dad being around more, and my brother and sister could have. It's not like he did anything wrong. It's just, you know, he lived in at a time in a society where that just really wasn't a priority or really even thought about. So, yeah, I call upon my own experience and it really does kind of bring it home, you know?
Well, the congressman made the point, and I'm so glad that he did, about getting over, you know, these like bullshit notions of gender roles, and that parenting is women's work and all of that. And he literally said, listen, I'm a linebacker. Like if I'm less of a man because I wanted to spend time with my kid, you know, say that to my face, basically. So that's one side of it. But then, you know, how much of this is also, you know, as we, you know, we talked about the stigma, even if you are allowed to take time off, you know, there still being a stigma behind men doing that, and as you mentioned at the top, behind women doing that, behind anybody taking time off to be with their kids while we preach family values. And so much of this goes back to this kind of ideal of American industriousness, right? And this work ethic that we have that, like, you know, those Western European countries don't have, because, you know, they only work like 6 hours a day and that kind of thing.
They take lunch breaks out here.
They take lunch breaks. What's that like? You know, those lazy communists, like, with their lunch breaks. But like, this is something that we see in sports so much. And I just remember every time an athlete's wife goes into labor and they decide to miss a game, right? We see this in baseball a lot because there's just a game every day for 3 months. But there's always some kind of talking head who yells about how, you know, you've got your priorities all wrong. How could you possibly miss a game? I mean, what is that like for you to witness as a father, as a sports writer, as a sports fan, obviously? Like, yes, sports are important, but maybe the birth of your child is too?
Right. There will always be another game, okay? There might not be another birth of your child. Like, you know, there's only so many of those, right? So, first of all, that right there, you talk about gender roles and that kind of thing, and just, you know, life being viewed in the media, particularly through a male point of view, right? That is like the absolute worst version of that, you know? And look, I mean, I'm a man. I see it all the time. It doesn't always occur to me, maybe even, because I live in that world, you know? But that is what you just outlined there is, first of all, is true. And secondly, is absolutely the worst version of that. There's no question. And secondly, look, I think a couple of things. Number one, what takes priority over your family, first of all, right? I mean, like, you know, like if you're, there's, your legacy is not going to be how many home runs you hit. It will be to, you know, the average Joe Sixpack. But your real legacy at home is going to be, you know, what impact you have on your children. And look, gender roles are first of all, ridiculous. And I think it's about time we're starting to do this. But I've always felt that, like, I will say this, right? So I think that if you're a human being who thinks about other people, you know, and you're a male in a heterosexual relationship, you have the woman, whatever the situation is, a work situation, it doesn't matter. But my point is, if you're in an equitable relationship and you see the work that goes into it, and yet don't step up and do your part, then I don't know what kind of person you are, because it's really freaking hard. Okay, it's hard as shit to raise kids. Okay, and I can remember being, you know, bringing it back to my own experiences again. But I can remember, you know, at times covering the NBA, you know, which is talk about, you know, long hours, right? But I was talking to my wife about this recently, and I said, you know, I hope that I got some credit for whenever the team was home on a homestand, I bent over backwards, right, to do as much as I could. And I was like, oh, I'm picking them up from school. I got it. And whatever it was, you know, take them to the park. I did everything, literally everything. Not because I'm a hero. No. I don't want that. I'm just saying because I felt so inadequate, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think you start to understand, you know, the more involved you get, the more you start to understand, like, maybe I need to do more. I'm not doing my part, because you realize how much there is to do and how much, right, and how much of a commitment there is. And at the end of the day, I also think that fathers in general don't realize, I think, some of the voids that are left when they're not quite as involved. And I'm not talking about absent fathers. I'm talking about, no, if you're the dad that's, oh, I got to work. Well, you know what? Your kid isn't going to remember the fact that you worked long hours. They don't care about that. They don't even know what you do, probably. They don't even understand what you do at work. What they'll remember is you picked me up from school and you took me for ice cream. You know what I mean? Yeah. And, you know, my daughter still talks about that. You know, that was our thing. When I was able to have, you know, because I do have that flexibility, you know, that was our thing. We pick her up from school, we go get frozen yogurt or something. And, you know, those little memories you make, they're not only memories, but they're also opportunities. You know, there's lessons being taught there. There's this growth happening that you don't even realize. And I don't know. I just think that if we as a society really want to progress, we need everybody. We need mothers, fathers, we need everybody. And I just think I'm happy that this is finally a priority.
What are your and your daughter's ice cream flavors?
So for her, it's more about the toppings, really. It's like, every single topping available. Okay, that's the answer.
She's getting her money's worth of pink berries.
Yes, yes. I was like, first of all, like, you are not taking that in my car. Okay, like, no, we're gonna sit here and eat that. I am like so boring. I'm so boring. I'm like, and now I'm getting older and I worry about calories. So it's like, hey, you have any, like, you know, sherbet or something? It's just like ridiculous. Like, who am I becoming? But yeah. She's still at that stage where it's like, how many toppings would it take for this thing to completely, like, collapse?
Collapse, right?
Yeah.
I'm always, it always wilds me out when I go into Pinkberry and I'm like, rainbow cookies are a topping? Rainbow cookies are a dessert.
Like, right. Like, is that on the menu by itself? Can I just buy those?
I feel like part of this paid parental leave conversation also, you know, like, we can't ignore the rhetoric that we use as a society, particularly around Black fatherhood, right? And, you know, there are all kinds of studies, and they're all true, about how, you know, two-parent households raise more successful kids. It's better for the kid when there are two parents in the household. Doesn't matter the gender. But that's just, you know, that kind of a family structure is better. That's absolutely not to say that single mothers or single fathers have not raised incredibly successful kids. Representative Allred is one of them.
Right.
But all of the studies do point to that. Now, on the other side, a whole bunch of a particular part of the political spectrum likes to point to those studies as fodder to further kind of the pathology of the absent Black father, right? And we have seen that is more and more of a myth as the years and the decades go on, right? How much do you think that paid parental leave can help that conversation steer toward more of what reality is and away from kind of the stereotypes that, oh, you know, black fathers are never around. And the idea that fatherhood in general is just important as an involvement.
Well, no, it's a great point, because I think at the core, what do we really hope this accomplishes? In my mind, I think the answer is strengthen families and just, mm-hmm. I mean, I think there are other obvious benefits, right? There's a lot of benefits. First of all, you know, it make things more equitable. All of those things are really important. But I think the goal in the end is, you know, have stronger families, better adjusted kids, whatever the case might be. I mean, I think the family ultimately benefits, right? And so, you know, I think the conversation or the point, excuse me, you made earlier and Congressman Allred made about lower income families, you know, that's, look, there are financial challenges among, you know, our black families in many cases. And that's just not to say we're all, you know, living check to check, right? But certainly there are some, there definitely, that exists, right? So that's fine. And we do make up a greater percentage sometimes of those lower income families. So, and yet, they're not benefiting from any of these conversations in most of those spaces. So, if we're able to tap into some of that, it can only help. And I just think that sometimes, you know, the economics are such a burden to some of our black families as well. And who's there to help? The system doesn't ever really work in your favor, right? If you have to legislate things at this point, you know, the way America is constructed, capitalism is such that unless it's legislated, you know, they're not going to just volunteer it, especially where we're talking, the spaces that we're talking about.
America's running a business, not a charity.
Yes. Yes. Can we just like dispense with the BS? So anyway, my point is, I do think that, yes, there definitely there's a lot of stress on black families. There's no question about it. And look, I think a lot of times we've seen in economic recoveries, for example, when, you know, when there's a downturn in the economy, look at what's happened over the past year, right? Mm-hmm. We've seen that upper middle class and even, I guess, a lot of middle class Americans have largely been unaffected financially. Just like, I mean, to be completely honest with you, my life hasn't changed financially. You know what I'm saying? Thank right. God. I'm so happy to say that. And then you,
and for a lot of people also hasn't, like, if you are of a certain level of means, mm-hmm. the struggles of raising kids hadn't been exacerbated to the same level. You know, you have all these reports of, you know, wealthy families in the suburbs being able to hire private tutors for their neighborhoods and maintain social distancing because they've got classrooms of like four people, right?
Right. Like, that is like not reality, you know, for most people.
For most of us, right? Yeah.
So, I mean, my daughter has a math tutor. He charges $20 an hour, right? <It's> like, so I don't consider that putting me in the 1%, you know. Yeah. But anyway, like, you're exactly right, though. I mean, I just think that, you know, here in the real world, you know, people really are deeply affected by this. There's such a discrepancy in how people have been affected, you know, or are affected through these economic downturns. And I think the last thing you're going to do in a situation like that when you're stretched is take time off from work when you can least afford it, you know. But what if you could do that and get paid and your family could benefit from it as well, simultaneously? I mean, what a novel thought, right? So I agree. That's a very, very long-winded way of saying I agree with your original point, which is that I do think many of our black families could benefit greatly from this.
Yeah. Well, last thing I wanted to talk to you about that we talked about with the congressman, it was so interesting to talk to someone like him who readily admitted that football was a means to an end. Like, he had no notions of doing this professionally. It was kind of on a, you know, he was an undrafted free agent when he signed with the Titans, and it was, you know, he used it to go to Baylor, to go to college, and he took the LSATs. He wanted to go into law. You know, how many in your coverage, I mean, you can speak to this, how many players, and the NCAA is kind of built upon this lie of how many D1 players can actually go on to play professionally, and then they see their dreams shatter in front of them, right? I mean, like, what do you think about that dynamic of having more and more people just come out and say, sports for me is a vehicle to better my life and to get to this place that I want to be, this profession that I want to do?
Well, first of all, what I would say is that for the schools, these athletes are a means to an end. Okay. Mm. So let's just start with that, right? I mean, they are a vehicle to earning money for the schools and the conferences. That's really what it is. I mean, certainly at the elite levels, right? Maybe at smaller divisions, obviously the economics are different. But the schools you're tuning in to watch in March, okay, on CBS, right? Those, they're in it for the money, okay? There is no greater incentive than that, all right? It's not about school pride, okay? But anyhow, what I'd say is, first of all, I love that he said that, right? And it's great perspective, and it's what most athletes should, it's how most athletes should view it. I mean, frankly, What else is it but a means to an end? Your end might be different than one athlete's end may be different than another's, right? For a basketball player, you know, who's an All-American and goes to Kentucky, we know it's a means to an end for him, right? And the means the end is the NBA draft. But, you know, for like the congressman, it was, you know, I want to use this for a stepping stone to the next stage of my life. Where this gets complicated, though, especially if you're a high level athlete or playing at a high level program, where this gets complicated is, you know, do you have the support from the program and the university to actually pursue what you want to pursue? Now, there are many instances where I've covered college sports over the years as well, and there are many instances where I've heard people say things like, "Well, yeah, that's really not a football major. What's a football major?" You know what I mean? Do I have to major in sociology? You know, and there really is almost a
shots fired at sociology majors, by the way.
Well, I mean, I hate that, but like I've seen that so much over the years. Like, why?
You know, totally a thing. Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. Like, I loved sociology, by the way.
Sociology is great. Honestly, I think
it was like one of my favorite classes.
If more people were required to learn the systems of how social interaction work, the country would be better off. But anyway, that's a whole other podcast episode.
Yeah, there's no question. The professors I remember are my journalism professors and my sociology professors. Because that's the only stuff I cared about, I guess. But anyhow, I'm getting off track. But my point is, I really do think that the schools, whether it be the coaches or whatever, whoever, you know, is taking an active role in, you know, saying these things or at least, you know, creating these ideas, you know, that you maybe can't pursue a biology major, you know, if you're playing football. I mean, you have to really buck the trend and go against the grain, you know, to pursue things like that. And what do? They have, when these kids come on campus, one of the first things they're doing is meeting with their advisors, right? And those advisors are very, very much in tune with the athletic programs and they know what they want. They know what the time commitments are, all of that. And so anyway, my point is you have to be very focused and very determined as an athlete. If you want to pursue something that's, you know, outside of the norm, so to speak, I think. And so congrats to the congressman for understanding that, I think. And I wish that schools would help these kids do that and better enable them to do that when they want.
Well, 100%. And my last point, my last question here will be, you know, I feel like a lot of people, especially in the conversation about, you know, name, image, and likeness rights, paying players, compensating players in some way, so many people on the opposite side of that, we'll point to someone like Congressman Allred and say, look, he used football. He got a college scholarship. He graduated from Baylor. Then he went to law school. And now he's a congressman. And clearly that, you know, that degree in exchange for his service on the team is compensation enough, right? So many people are going to say something like that.
Yeah, but I mean, it goes back to what I was saying earlier about capitalism. It's like, are we a capitalist society or not? You know what I mean? Like if I can capitalize on who I am and my abilities, who are you to tell me I can't? I think, is it Georgia that we saw a bill being pursued this week that would require the students that earn money from their image and likeness to distribute some of that money to other members of the athletic program, which, okay, maybe if you're the third string left tackle, maybe that's good for you. But like, I mean, again, that goes against the concept of capitalism and everything America's supposed to be built on. So, like, I can't keep up. I don't know what country I live in sometimes. You know what I mean? It's like, right. are we in America? Are we in France? Or I mean, I don't know. Where are we? So, I think the it goes to, and this is not exactly answering your question, but it just goes to what we already know, which is the ideas and what's important and so forth is always established by who's in charge. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so whether we want to flip the switch to capitalism or not is dependent on, you know, who's making that decision, I guess, you know, so here we are.
Right. Well, Stephen, thank you so much for joining us. It was so thrilling to talk to you and the congressman. And these are conversations we're definitely going to need to continue for months and years ahead.
I suspect that's right.
All right. Thanks so much, Stephen. Thank you for joining us on Culture Calculus. I'm Kavitha Davidson for The Athletic. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to give us a rating if you can as well. And make sure to tune in every Thursday. We'll have a different episode, a different guest, and a different topic at hand. Thanks again for listening. See you next week.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.